The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Alan Adamson. Alan is a noted industry expert in all disciplines of branding and marketing. He is co-founder and managing partner of Metaforce, a marketing strategy and activation firm. Prior to Metaforce, Alan was chairman North America of Landor Associates, a global brand consulting and design firm. Alan writes a monthly column for Forbes.com about the impact of general business and cultural trends on branding and specifically how brands can break through in a world of communication overload. He is the author of four books, Brand Simple, Brand Digital, The Edge, 50 Tips from Brands That Lead, as well as his newest book that he co-authored with Joel Steckel. It's called Shift Ahead, How the Best Companies Stay Relevant in a Fast-Changing World. Alan, welcome to the show.
Thanks. After that intro, I should probably cut it off here because the rest is going to be downhill.
Exactly. It's a very accomplished intro. Okay. So one of the many takeaways in this book, I think there are two quotes that sum up a pretty central theme that is core to the theories and the case studies. And they're this. The first quote is, quote, businesses must understand why they matter to customers. All right. And the second is, quote, find the desk farthest away from the customer, and that's where the person in charge sits.
Yep, both are, you know, when we started to write this book, we looked down and said, gee, you know, why is every time we look in the paper or listen to some news, you know, somebody else is going out of business, is restructuring, is refinancing, and, you know, didn't they see that train coming? And lots of the reasons that companies, organizations, big and small, get run over by the pace of change is the second quote, which is the executive in charge is so far removed from reality on the 14th floor behind closed doors that unless somebody pulls them out or her out of the office, they can't see the change coming.
Yeah, and this is a thing I talk about a lot because we know this in our work in improvisation, that you have to constantly remain humble as a communicator because you're receiving all these offerings from the person who's crossing you, and you never know what it's going to be or what character they're going to be. And often in our work lives, we have a fair amount of success, and so we play the same pattern. We just run the same play, and we're not connected to things that have changed either on the ground or in the broader scheme of things. And that's really what this is about, is like there's things changing in the world, and there's things changing, you know, like on your floor where your workers are.
Most people are either removed or in a bubble or not listening or not paying attention.
There's another quote that I loved. It says, quote, victory in the charge to stay relevant will definitely belong to those organizations inherently conditioned to think about the big things while literally doing the small things.
Yeah, devil's in the details. People, you know, the greatest customer experience, you know, no one wants to create a bad customer experience, but why do so many end up doing that? Because they say we're gonna deliver customer satisfaction, and that's as far as they take the thinking and leave it to everyone else to figure out how to do that.
You talk a lot in the book about culture, and there was a quote from the Harvard Business Review blog that said, quote, culture guides discretionary behavior, and it picks up where the employee handbook leaves off. Culture tells us how to respond to an unprecedented service request. Employees make hundreds of decisions on their own every day, and culture is our guide. So talk to us a bit about that. I think people think of culture as being this ethereal thing, and I think what you're saying is, no, it is the day-to-day.
Yeah, I mean, there's another famous quote, without overdoing it for your listeners, you know, culture eats strategy for lunch.
Yep.
And, you know, the best companies have a culture of listening and challenging and questioning and a little bit of paranoia, that from the famous founder of Intel saying only the paranoid survive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, part of that, you smell when you interact with a company. When we one of the stories in the book was FedEx, and you know, part of FedEx strength today is that it has a culture of certainty. Absolutely, you know, must, you know, that package needs to be delivered or that envelope, they're going to do it. And all the way going back to the old movie Castaway with Tom Hanks, where you know he's stranded on a Pacific island, but when he is rescued, the first thing he does is deliver the package. So, you know, once people inside understand what they call the purple promise of whatever it takes to deliver,
mm-hmm.
you don't need to tell anyone how to respond to someone when they call up and say, gee, my package isn't here. It's not, well, I'm sorry to hear that. Let me set up an investigation and call you in 3 weeks. You know, even their response team is has a special ops sort of feeling, customer advocacy yeah, squad team, I forget what mm-hmm. it was, but, you know, so they're all attuned to understanding that the company's survival depends on absolute certainty. And if it's that simple, you don't have to write a handbook on how to deliver absolute certainty to customers.
And why isn't it that simple? I mean, what are all these businesses getting wrong when it comes to not only defining their culture, but then communicating that in a way that the employees can easily understand and make it part of their working lives?
Yeah, part of it is culture is, as we've just been talking, critically important, but really hard to change.
Mm.
Joel and I talked about it in the book. You know, if I could practice basketball, you know, every day for 10 hours a day, but since I'm 5'8", unlikely I'm going to make a career out of it.
Yeah.
So certain companies have a certain DNA, certain strength inherently in their culture. And if they are, you know, process-driven and engineering-driven, then becoming a culture of creativity sounds like a good idea, but it's going to be a really long haul. You know, we saw that a lot. In fact, recently when we looked at the shift to head change, Verizon, very strong engineering company, you know, their business was built on can you hear me now and mm-hmm. making sure they built enough cell towers and enough relays and enough software so that when you connected, your calls were dropped less than the other guys. Went out and said, well, we're going to get in the content business. And they went out and they bought Yahoo and Huffington Post, and they were going to build this whole content engine of all these creative businesses to grow. Because if you're selling pipes like Verizon is, it quickly falls into, you know, why should I pay more for your pipe than someone else? Come mm-hmm. on and do that. But because the culture was so different, after a year and a half of trying, they basically pulled the plug, and they've been selling off pieces of that. It'll be interesting to see what happens to AT&T. And,
right.
You know, a perfect test case when, you know, they've taken all their bundles of money from, you know, building out telecommunications, and now they own HBO and other creative shops. And can those two cultures come together, or will one culture eat the other for lunch?
Yeah, it's rare that those mergers work. And,
yeah.
And we had interviewed Howard Yu, who wrote a great book called Leap, and it's about why companies can be successful over hundreds of years. And he talks about companies creating adjacent expertise that, you know, they continue to they do the thing they do well, but then they sort of figure out that things change. And so how can they pivot? Very much what you talk about. And one of the examples that I thought was fascinating was American Express. I had just assumed it started with the credit card, but I think you say in the book that company was about 108 years old when it launched its first credit card.
Right, and you know, they were in the shipping business, Express. They managed to do a couple shifts. Now, again, the jury's out on their latest shift as money is changing into something you certainly no longer pull out of your wallet in paper form, but even pull out of your wallet in plastic form.
Mm-hmm.
Are they going to be able to pivot to the world of digital money and money transferring from one phone to the other? the jury's out. They've had a tough couple of years, but they need to, once again, make as big a shift as they perhaps did going from shipping freight around the world to figuring out how to go from a little piece of plastic in your wallet to a new type of money.
Yeah. I also didn't realize that they had an artists-in-residence program.
Yeah, that was one of the interesting stories. You know, part of where you started the conversation was the officers from the customers where the leaders live and often in the bubble. And when we spoke to the CMO, John Hayes, he said, you know, they knew that they needed to stay relevant. And so rather than just talk to 15 management consultants who would all basically regurgitate what they already had inside, they all had the same DNA as the people at American Express, John said, you know, I need to get to artists and actors and people who see what's around the corner, who may have different radar than all the geeks on my floor wearing pocket protectors. And so he not only hired, you know, real Hollywood talent for the commercials, but then asked them, whether it's Bono or others, to be his advisor, be his long-term radar, be his eyes and ears, and try to help him and the leadership team see what was coming around the corner. Another great story in that was with HBO, actually, speaking of entertainment. Mm-hmm. When I spoke to the president of HBO, they said, well, you know, normally big companies hire interns, and they hire them from good schools, and they put them in the mailroom, and they see if they can, you know, sort out problems in the mailroom, and they send them to get coffee. But at HBO, they said, we brought in interns, not for the, you know, grunt work. We took our board and our leadership team and gave them interns, mm-hmm. Because we wanted them to learn to be digital, see how millennials were living, see mm-hmm. how they lived their lives, wanted it in their face of the leadership team, not so much, you know, helping them, you know, get coffee and figure out what's going on in the accounting department, but to educate the leaders as to how younger people were living completely different from the world they grew up in to prevent HBO from becoming your father's Oldsmobile.
Yeah, and this is the reason that there's so much evidence around the importance of diversity in the workplace, because, you know, you start to, we're naturally drawn to people who look like us and people who agree with us. And you write in the book, quote, "Don't confuse a common purpose with homogeneity of perspective."
Yeah, I mean, that's the other big thing. Most of the companies we looked at, we said, you know, why do they have struggled to shift ahead? And there was no magic recipe. And most fail when they try to. And one of the reasons they fail is they hire people just like them. Mm-hmm. Oh, this person went to my school, and they know they go to the same club I go to, and they like the same food. And all of a sudden, everyone's drinking the same Kool-Aid. And so when something changes, they, you know, they all have the same myopic vision. They can't see it coming. They live in the same bubble, and they believe in the same thing, read the same papers, they watch the same TV shows, and you don't have a view of the world. So companies that tend to attract people just like them are the very vulnerable to being a headline in some business school book saying whatever happened to blank.
Mm-hmm. All right. So one of the things you talk about in the book is this, you know, how do you put yourself in a position to see into the future? Because in many ways, that's an impossible ask, because we have no idea, you know, what's going to be happening. But there are ways to sort of get ourselves in the best place to make that guess. Amy Webb talks about this thing, the paradox of the present, which I think is fascinating. I saw her speak at a conference about this, but I'd love you to sort of take us through, you know, that thinking.
I mean, there's lots of people who are great at predicting the future, whether it's Amy or Faith. You know, they tend to get a pretty good guess on what will happen. Because lots of people say, you know, you don't have to be a futurist to know that internal combustion automobiles are not going to be around in X years. Mm-hmm. The issue is, what's X?
Yeah,
is right. X this year, next year, or 30 years from now? And so, you know, that is a challenge for predicting the future. One of the things, simple things we found, that for companies that are better able to see what's around the corner, besides, you know, the American Express story of hiring artists who have that ability to see through the fog, is that lots of companies play tennis and not golf when they're doing business. Now, what do we mean by that? When I was at Unilever in marketing, we would claim to be very, we're in touch with what consumers want. We're paying close attention, and we understand their needs. But most of the time, we were, if P&G did something, we ran to do that. If Colgate did something, we were really focused on what our direct competitors are doing. When I worked with Pepsi, yes, we were interested in what kids were drinking, but we were more interested in what Coke was doing. Mm-hmm. And I played both sports badly, but if you're playing tennis, you can do better if you hit the ball with a person's not. You really focus on what your competitor is doing. And too many businesses in this country, are totally preoccupied with playing tennis, watching their direct competitor. If one person, you assume that, if they're doing that, they must know what they're doing. Let me just follow them. I play golf pretty badly too, but I don't, when I'm playing it, you're not as focused on what your partner's doing. You don't want to hit him with a ball or a club. But to be good at golf, you really need to sort of look out where you're trying to hit, think about your own game, think about the course, think about the wind. And so one of the ways to be more prepared to for the future is to, zoom out a bit and look at the world beyond your little ecosystem, whether it's, your Pepsi worrying about Coke or Gillette worrying about Schick. I mean, that was another great example of, for years, all they had to do was make a better blade than Schick, and they were winning the game, which wasn't that big a challenge.
Right.
Until somebody, Dollar Shave, Harry, said, gee, I wonder if, I wonder if we looked at a different category to try to figure out how to beat Gillette.
Yeah, amazing. One of the things about sort of future thinking in our work, the whole yes and philosophy is around trying to create something that we can never create alone, the idea that all of us are better than one of us, and that these ideas are going to be, they're weird, and we have to allow them to be weird. And when you're staying in yes and, you're sort of forced to do that because we're not naturally there. And you talk in the book about the need to listen to the fringe, the ideas on the edge, because often that will give us an inkling of what the center is going to look like later, right?
Yep. Most people do the research in Manhattan or in L.A. They need to get, much further off the edge, because change doesn't happen usually from the center. It happens from the outside. And, the other thing is it's often happening in the arts. If you look back in historical context, you watch an old episode of Star Trek from the 60s, and that would have been your roadmap if you wanted to succeed in Silicon Valley, from iPads to touch wearable technology to, so even the great movie 2001, you go parts of that movie, there's a total roadmap for what's going to happen in technology from telecommunications on down. So part of it is, going to neighborhoods, going to parts of the country, parts of the world that you ordinarily don't hang out in, and going in with open eyes and not, getting into your hotel room and popping on whatever you were watching back home.
Right.
And talking to people, listening to people, and part of it is looking at the arts. Creative people tend to embrace change more than most players in the corporate world.
And I think the other thing that happens a lot in the arts is many artists are forced to constantly be in conversation with their audience, and over and over again. So they learn to listen to their audience because they have to.
And you get instant feedback,
Yes.
Most companies make a product and, maybe they didn't sell it, but they really never talk to the customer. Why didn't they buy it? Just didn't sell it or try something else? If you're out there every day trying to, saying, is this good, any good, what do you think of this, and you're really listening and watching your customer, you have a better shot. That's another major finding was companies lost something called the founder's mentality.
Yeah.
This ability to, my father-in-law was in the shopping mall business for his life, and he would take me to walk through the mall, and to me that would be torture. I need sneakers, so I can get them, and it would be a tour of, look what's going on here. And he never lost that observational passion for watching people behave. Because people won't, as everyone knows, people say that I don't do this, I hate this. Very different than how they act. And the best people that can sort of see what's going on tend to be great observers of how people are behaving versus what they're saying.
Right, because people don't tell you the truth. I mean, yeah. and for many reasons, they don't want to hurt your feelings. But sometimes they don't know. I mean, no one said, I am going to want an iPhone.
Right, that's Steve Jobs' famous quote, you know. When we did some interviews in the telecom business, early on, it was you asked people, would they pay $700 for a cellular phone? You were laughed out of the room. And so Nokia was doing tons of research, and they were convinced that no one would pay more than $100 for a cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
And same with BlackBerry. It was, oh, no one is ever going to stop wanting a keyboard. Who wants to type on a screen with their fingers? And so we are totally fine. All the research we're doing is people saying they would never give up their little BlackBerry and their keyboard. Famous last words.
Yeah.
Both of them.
And you talk about one of the sort of red flags is this arrogance, that institutional and professional arrogance, and BlackBerry was an example of yours for that.
Yeah, most companies, the more successful you are, the more confident you become. And the more confident you are, the less open you are to seeing change, and the more arrogant you are. And lots of companies, the bigger, the more successful the business, the faster the rise, the bigger the egos of the leadership team, the less likely they are to saying, hey, maybe we need to change things up versus, oh, it's been working great for the last 3 years, let's just push ahead. Onward.
Right. I was interested in the way you talked about the Kodak story, because the cautionary tale people seem to tell about Kodak is that they got left behind and they didn't see the writing on the wall, but they did.
Yeah, that was I had the privilege of working with Kodak when I was in the agency business. They were a client, and at that point, way back when, they were, you know, they were the client to have. You could do phenomenal creative work. They were sponsors of the Olympics. You know, they owned pictures. And, you know, I made the assumption that, gee, they just, as you just said, they didn't see the train coming down the pike. And so we did some research with a whole bunch of people who worked there for, during, and after they disappeared, although they're still around as a tiny B2B business. And one of the surprising findings was, their strategic forecasting people knew about 8 years in advance, almost to the month, certainly to the quarter, the year and quarter that digital photography would pass film photography. So they knew 8 years in advance. More than that, they had accumulated lots of patents in digital, so they had, you know, they even had the recipe how to cook a different picture.
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, how did that, what happened? And, you know, if you saw this 8 years in advance, you couldn't do anything with it. You even had the technology. And more interviews reveals that, you know, it was a bit of golden handcuffs that prevented it, because the film business was so phenomenally profitable back then. Their margins, you know, it was 70%. They made 70 cents on every dollar they sold. And, with that type of money, it was really hard to tell the film people, say, look, we're going to take some of your money and your profits, instead of paying you big bonuses and doing these great sales meetings and sponsoring the Olympics and doing all these la-di-da things today, we're going to take some of that and we're going to invest it in digital and make what they called an asymmetrical bet.
Mm.
And they couldn't move money inside the company. One is because Wall Street said, what do you mean you're going to make less money this year than or this quarter?
Right.
No, you would make the maximum amount of money every quarter. So they couldn't take a long view. So they couldn't move money. The only thing for sure is if they sold a roll of film, they'd make 70 cents. If they tried to sell digital photography, they would lose 20 cents, 30 cents, you know, they would lose money in every dollar. And so even inside the company, even though they had the great GPS and they had the technology, they couldn't shift from one to the other because they had golden handcuffs.
Yeah.
The other interesting thing about the Kodak story was where you started on culture, that they were a chemical and sales company.
Hmm.
And they didn't have the digital DNA. So when they built digital, they tried to build it with the same people that were used to chemistry and sales, and not engineering and coding and inventing new businesses. And so they didn't have the right DNA even to apply the technology they had purchased.
So that's an example of a company that was sort of addicted to growth, addicted to this profitable business model, and that stood in their way. You talk about Hasbro, which had a very different kind of problem. I just couldn't believe this, that in 2008, they owned 1,500 brands and were losing billions of dollars.
Yeah, there are two problems. One is that they had been buying more and more brands. Mm-hmm. You know, the basic business 101 is if you don't focus and execute, you doesn't matter what you have. And so they were spending everything to support all these brands, and some were nice, and some were no longer nice. So you know, the easy thing to do was to say we need to just focus on the top six and make those extraordinary. Because another thing we learned in one of the conversations we had was with the columnist Tom Friedman, mm-hmm. and his notion is, that average is over. To be successful today, if you do everything averagely, you'll disappear. And so Hasbro was in the, we're doing 100 toys averagely, and they needed to be doing 10 toys extraordinarily. The other thing was a culture change, which to your opening ideas and questions. They brought in, when they were having this trouble, they brought in the CEO from a tiny film division they had in Hollywood. And the toy company almost rejected him. They said, well, what does this little filmmaker know about, he was a little bit more than a little filmmaker, mm-hmm. know about Monopoly and games and Toy Fair and holidays and Toys R Us? But he was able to bring in some entertainment expertise, and because he brought that in, Hasbro was one of the first toy makers to embrace this integration between toys and entertainment. Now Lego has followed, and recently, in the last month, Mattel has finally announced they're going to try to create some content and entertainment along with trying to convince you that Barbie is still relevant.
Yeah, so they had to recognize that they weren't necessarily in the toy business anymore, they were in the entertainment business.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right. In a moment, I'm going to ask you for a yes and story, which is how we always end the podcast. But before that, I did not know the sort of story, the founding story around Marriott International. And it's a tremendous story. They were founded in 1927, and they weren't a hotel then, were they?
No, they were in the food business and the ice cream business. And, so they, like most entrepreneurs, they don't end up where they start, but the Marriott learned how to serve ice cream and make, fast food back in those days, and learned the importance of, back to what you said, it's important to improv, is just seeing instant customer reaction when you serve them something versus you check into a hotel, you're unhappy, you might write an email a couple days later. So they really learned that agility is part of their DNA, and that customers, the importance of that frontline service person, that if you don't serve it with a smile, if you're not friendly and fun and engaging to be with, then you're not going to be successful in the hospitality business.
And that story that Bill Marriott talks about his dad, when a cook didn't show up one day because he was sick, and the dad basically put a doctor on the payroll and started taking care of healthcare.
Exactly.
Amazing.
Because they took a long view, and staying close to the customers. Another quote from great Marriott, Bill Marriott, was they used to say his feet never touched a desk when he was running the company. He didn't sit behind closed doors on the 14th floor. He would be visiting hotels, talking to bell captains, talking to people at the front desk, in the kitchens, always on the road, constantly saying, "How are we doing? How are you doing?" And realizing that if his employees weren't happy, he could have the right strategy, but his customers wouldn't be happy.
We should note, too, that it was 30 years after they were founded that they saw the Pentagon building going up, and that's when they opened their first motor hotel just across the river.
Right. Again, seeing changes before other people. So lots of people were seeing the highways being built. Not many people said, gee, people are going to be taking long drives. They may not get to their destination. Maybe they'll need to stay along the way and get off the highway and not be looking for anything else other than a nice place to spend the night before they get on the highway again.
Wow. All right. So I want to ask you for a yes and story. So this is a time in your work or your life when you normally would have said no, but instead you didn't just stop at yes. You said yes and. Do you have one of those stories for us?
Yeah, so I was working in the advertising business early in my career, and a colleague came. He said, look, Alan, I can ask you a favor. I teach a class Monday nights here at the agency for the new school, and I can't do it tonight. My kid has toothache, and can you just come and teach the class for me? And I said, yes, but I really can't do this ever again, and, so I did a yes and, mm-hmm. and I loved it.
Mm.
And that led me to do more classes with him and ultimately take over the class and ultimately take a job on the side teaching at NYU as an adjunct. And it opened up a whole different part of my life that instantly my instinct was, no, find somebody else. I'm not a teacher. You don't have time. It's Monday night. I'm buried in work. Why are you teaching a class anyway at the agency? But I said yes, and I'll do my best, but you got to do a few things, and it changed my life.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about, my wife's a teacher, and when I've been able to be lucky enough to do that, it forces you to clarify your ideas and potentially simplify, but also look for the deeper understanding. And then in that communication with the students, and you learn so much from them in terms of not just the idea you had, but how that idea can be expanded or played with.
If I hadn't taught, I would never have been able to write a book, because
right.
You have to be able to not only understand what you're talking about, most people do, but even more importantly, how to clarify it and make it able to be transmitted to someone who doesn't live in the same bubble you do.
Yep. The book is called Shift Ahead, How the Best Companies Stay Relevant in a Fast-Changing World. Alan Admonson, thank you for coming on the show.
My pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
Getting to SAN is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is L.F. Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
survive.